Thank you. Actually, Howie and I look at these problems very similarly, and perhaps you're cheated to that extent, but perhaps I can give a little different viewpoint on it. I think the first thing conservatives have to ask themselves is what is the present of representative government more than what's the future of it? I feel very strongly that the conservative movement, by and large, has a jaundiced European hangover about what democratic politics is all about. And I think that's the fundamental crippling factor about the conservative movement in the United States, and it explains the extent of our losses and our inability to achieve power. I quote from one book, it could be from many others, by a prominent conservative. He isn't here. I'd mention his name if he were so he could defend himself. It's a book on property, and maybe many of you know who it is just from that. And he's looking for the problem. Why is property under attack today? He says it's unlimited democracy because that means unlimited majority rule. The people become rulers, the voice of God. Democratic government, the mouthpiece for the underprivileged masses, endeavor to gain a more equal distribution of property. All right, that's what the problem is, according to this view. That's what the conservatives are up against, these masses demanding equality and benefits. And, of course, this goes back to de Tocqueville, who I respect mightily. It's as old as de Tocqueville. It's as recent as the last Mount Pelerin meeting when Professor Hayek also blamed the people for inflation. I think that that is a very distorted view about what politics is about. And especially in groups which are mainly of economists, who think that since the market is rational, that politics should be rational also, I think is a very misunderstood view. The fundamental fact about politics is that preferences are not necessarily translated into politics. It's the fundamental fact that makes it very different from a market. In a market, we know that preferences are translated into outputs, into things we get, because you pay something and you get something. I'm guilty of social science, as Leah Rustin put it, but I'm going to bore you with some facts, even though they're not going to be as clear facts as what the state flower of New York is. But I think they're clear, and I think the reason that no one's seen the facts before are because the only ones that have looked at the facts of public opinion have been from the left. And that's true. As far as I know, and this is my field, there's never been a conservative or any man from the right that has empathetically looked at public opinion. Matter of fact, there haven't been many on the left either, because, and I think there's a good reason for that, because those who got serious about it, like Seymour Martin Lipset, like V.O. Key, and hundreds of others that I, Hadley Cantrell, Lloyd Free, when they look at it, they know what the people think and they turn away from it and then they start talking about elites and so forth. Now, how about these demands that come from the people? Survey Research Center at the University of Michigan the last couple of elections has asked the question, what do you think are problems for the government in Washington to take care of? Over the past 10 years when they've been asking this question, no policy has ever received a majority except the question of Vietnam, which I think most conservatives think foreign policy is something for the federal government to take care of. Even a general policy area, which I define very widely, no more than 37% of people have ever demanded that a particular social, political, or economic problem be solved by government. The highest single policy that they said should be solved is crime, and that was only 29% after three probes made to say, what is a problem? They give one, give me another one, give me another one. By the time they asked three, only 40% of the people were giving anything, 60% weren't. And we find this all through the history of polls. Gallup's been doing this since 1935. In 1936, no one policy was mentioned by more than 4% of the people, and 54% wanted nothing. In 1942, 47% wanted nothing. 1948, 66% wanted nothing. 1959, 62% wanted nothing. 1967, 60% didn't want anything. Now, again, I'm throwing a lot of figures at you, but that's the only way I know how to make my point. Because no one will listen to what I consider the essential facts. You've got to see the facts. A political scientist named Walke extended this to all democratic countries in the West and found in every one that was true. Now, I don't know anything about Britain or Italy or so forth that were talked about this morning, but I suspect the problem isn't the people there either. I mean, I just have to pick a couple to try to make the point. When Negroes in Los Angeles were asked after the riots, how do you think race relation problems should be solved? And they were given the alternatives of violence, government programs, and private voluntary means. 3% said violence, 19% said government, and 56% said private voluntary solution. All right, this is the people who are supposedly revolting from the government. Lou Harris, in a latest study, 70% of the people prefer local government to solve problems over the other. When given a choice between national, state, local, and private for problems of the age, 26% say government given that choice. For housing, 14%. Even the big bugaboo supposedly of unemployment, 12% say national. This isn't the demand for government to solve problems. The area of equality, that's de Tocqueville's point. This is what's the undermining of democracy. The former head of the young, in his youth, the head of the Young Socialist League, and later president of the American Political Science Association, Robert Lane, said Americans fear equality because they think it's going to lead to a disorganized, uninteresting society. That's not a right-winger saying that. And, of course, why does he call it a fear of equality? Because they should love it. But he recognizes that they fear it. Why can't we? The data's all over the place on this. Let me, again, just give one. I could give you thousands. Ask yourself what you think the answer to this question would be. Now, of course, once you've heard me throw them out, you always discount. Try to say what you would have thought it would be before I said that. Of those people earning under $4,000 a year, what percent of them do you think would say that they thought that income should be redistributed so that everyone would get an equal income of $10,000? All right, that's people earning under $4,000 in 1969. What percent would say that everyone, the income should be redistributed to give $10,000? 14%. 14%. Now, this is a fact. I'm not making it up. This was done by Gallup. I'm not doing it. And he's not a conservative. Where do these things come from? I think you have to come to the conclusion. These people are not demanding government. They're not demanding solutions to these problems. You ask them all the time, if you give me an alternative. Now you say, well, I see Gallup and Harris polls all the time that say they want federal aid to education. They want. But what does he do? He says, do you want federal aid to education? Now, what does the average guy say? Federal? That means federal, state, local, right? Yeah, that's a good thing. Aid? Aid's a good thing. And education's a good thing. So I'm for it. All right, you get 60% of the people. But when you ask at the same time, and the liberals got a little confused there, they both went out in the November elections in 1964, and one asked it that way, and the other one got a little confused, and asked, would you prefer that state and local governments handle education all by themselves, or, hey, they gave him a choice now, this is very dangerous when you do that, or do you think it's, the federal government should help them? Now, that's a pretty innocuous way of framing it. More than 2-1 said it should only be done by state and local. Now, of course, you see all the time Gallup and Harris saying that they agree, but it's that mom and apple pie question, what I call. How the hell do you say you're again? Now, can you really say you're opposed to federal aid to education if it means that you don't want them to hurt it? I mean, since I'm in favor of federal aid to education. And remember, the average guy out there isn't a political science professor or even an economics professor. I think the most important thing to understand is that, again, the first rule of politics is that attitudes don't necessarily get translated into votes. Let's even look at the great success of the welfare state. Well, where does the welfare state come from? James McGregor Burns said, if you want to find out what is the driving force of the welfare state, you look at the presidential wing of the Democratic Party, not the congressional one, because they're smart enough to cool it and hedge it and not be so much in favor of it. How successful have they been? Since World War II, they won 3 times and they lost 4 times. That's not a hell of a lot of a great success rate, is it? All right, well, all right, forget about Post. Well, let's go back to Roosevelt. How did Roosevelt get elected? Let's remember that. 1932, what was Roosevelt's platform? Anti-government, balanced budget, gold? He was the conservative candidate, not Hoover. All right, how did he win in 1936? I have some beautiful poll data on this. People were asked before the election in 1936, do you approve of Franklin Delano Roosevelt personally? 80% said yes. Do you approve the way he's handling his presidency? 55% said yes. Do you approve of the way he's handling domestic policy? 36% said yes. Why was he elected in 1936? His charisma, his charm, he was getting something done, but he didn't like what he was doing. All through this period, people were opposed to balanced budgets, priming pumps, government regulating business. The data's all there again. 1940, how did he win? In my book, I go into this in a lot of detail. Look at the polls as World War II came in Europe. You know, we tend to think World War II started in 1941. That's when it hit us. Remember, it was 39 in Europe. As you watch the polls coming closer to that election, 55% were opposed to electing Roosevelt president in 1940 and 1938. And every month as you got closer to the invasion of Poland, it dropped to a plurality opposed to him, still more opposed than in favor of. After the fall of France, the first time a majority is going to vote for him. In 1944, the next election I have to explain. What happened then? Here I have pure laboratory cases. All right, those in the physical sciences might not like them, but as close as we can get to them in the social sciences. The same people were asked, would you vote for Roosevelt if the war is still going on in 1944? And then they were asked, would you vote for him if the war was over? And what happens? A majority said they vote for him if the war is still going on, and a majority would vote for against him if it was over. What did they vote for Roosevelt for? Because he was a foreign policy cold warrior. He liked his foreign policy. I've done a study of as many policies as you can get with public opinion polls. I find that 60% of the welfare policies were clearly opposed by a majority of the people, and 57% of the social policies were disapproved over this period. I think it's a tremendous myth to blame our present problems on the people. I mean, the people are out there trying to judge what the hell's going on. And the first rule of a politician is to confuse them. Huh? Now, you can't blame that guy out there. I can't. I'm a political scientist. All I do is follow. I don't know one millionth of what the hell they're doing down there with all those billions of things they're knocking back and forth there. Now, if I can't do it who spend full time, what about the guy who's out there working? He can't do it. You can't expect them to. He operates on the principle of trust. And you can't trust politicians, but they try to as best they can. I think the problem of conservatives is best illustrated by this. A guy named Barber did a psychological study of presidential character. And one of the things he looked at, one of the presidents he looked at was Nixon. And this was before Watergate. And he came up with a statement that Nixon made back in his early days, which unfortunately I don't have the exact quote, but it went something like this. I'm afraid of the people, because the people want to do things I don't want to do. They are greedy, they're demanding things, so I have to be clever. And that's the quote they got from him. I think that explains his whole personality and the whole problem, not the whole problem, but much of the problem of the conservative movement. They feel that that great beast out there is their enemy, and they have to be clever to outwit it. And when they try to be clever, they don't outwit it. They get their water gates. People act on a basis of trust. Now, how does politics work in the United States if it isn't the people? Howie outlined it. I have a big thing here, but Ed's not going to let me go through all of it. It's what the same Lane, who is now moving back to socialism again after a period of liberalism, he calls it interest group liberalism. All right, that's what the reigning ideology is in the United States. You give a little to everybody. But what the guys who were socialists, then in the 50s became liberals and going back to socialists again, are finally realizing something Madison told them in the first place. The only way interest group liberalism can work is if you don't give them much to do. All right, whatever they get, assume they're going to steal it. All right, or they're going to screw it up some way, but don't give them much. That's the only protection democratic government has ever had. I mean, how did Parliament limit the kings? Well, they knew they're going to do whatever the hell they wanted with the money once they got it. You just don't give them much. And that's the only way you can keep the system working halfway honestly is not give them much. And then you turn to the Republican Party, and what do you get? This is the party of cutting taxes. This is the party of cutting expenditures, right? Name one Republican that's done it. One. I was a campaign advisor, major campaign advisor to a local official. I said, you want to win this thing? I'll tell you what you do. Number one thing, we got a whole bunch of local Democrats living in each community, each neighborhood to sign the letter. And it said, my friend X is going to cut your taxes. Yeah? Personal appeal, this is what people like. Something they can trust, something straight. What did that son of a do when he got in office? He raised taxes. Now, do you blame anyone voting against the Republican after that? Nixon, the greatest deficits? This is a Republican a cutter? Now, can you blame them for voting against it? We're a bunch of hypocrites. They don't deserve their vote. That is, we as Republicans. Unless we do what we say we're going to do. You can't say the stupid people. They're smart. Now, the fact that they're electing a Democrat that's going to do worse, well, their feeling is, I'll kick these bums out this time, I'll kick those bums out the next time, and that's what they're going to do, by and large, unless we do something to stop them. Now, why should we do something to stop them? The worst thing that can happen to us is that Gerald Ford becomes reelected president the next time. Because, as James McGregor Burns pointed out about the Democratic Party, it's just as true about the Republican Party. So, as he said, the liberals exist in the presidential wing of both parties. And they do. There's some difference. The ones on the Republican side are somewhat more conservative than those on the Democratic side. They are trying to protect the selfish interest of business as they see them, in my opinion, improperly. The market is not the same thing as business. All right, so you say to yourself, hey, if they're the liberals, what are we going to do? Well, it seems to me there's only one other answer, and thank heaven the Founding Fathers gave us that. And that's a legislature. Right? That's what the only hope of the president of the conservative movement. Howie's idea of groups and organizing in local community fits in 100% with this. It's the only way we've got a chance. The basic fact about the House of Representatives from 1938 to 1965 was something called a conservative coalition. One of the reasons Roosevelt turned from domestic policy to foreign policy in 1938 is because the conservative coalition murdered him. When was the best presidency we've ever had? Under the most popular Democratic president, John Kennedy. The conservative coalition cut him apart. Beautiful rhetoric, gonna lead you into the next world and all that nonsense of the new frontier. We killed him. We murdered them. They didn't get a thing. Now, what's the basic fact? The basic fact is since 1938, the Republicans have had around 170 members of the House. And of these, 140 are conservative. There are 125 Southern Democrats, and of these, 75 are conservative. 140 Northern Democrats, of these, 5 are conservative. 140 plus 75 plus 5 is 220. A majority in the House is 218. That's the political fact of life. That through this period, the reason that we kept as much a break on them as we could is because we had a leadership that knew how to use the conservative coalition. Someone mentioned Charles Halleck, I think it was Professor Dornan, mentioned Charles Halleck as teaching him most about politics. Charles Halleck knew how to use the conservative coalition. Even after this latest election, my rough count is that there are 196 members of the conservative coalition in the present Congress, which leaves us 22 short of a majority. That's not impossible. But we've got to use it. Now, let me remind you of something every one of you has forgotten, I bet. Who announced the end of the conservative coalition and when? Remember I said from 1938 to 1965. Who became minority leader in 1965? It's the same guy who is president today. His first press conference, he got up and he said, no more backroom politics. The conservative coalition between Republicans and Southern Democrats is ended. From now on, we are going to build constructive Republican alternatives. I don't know who first noticed that that comes out to something similar to crap. We're going to build conservative Republican alternatives and no longer deal with the conservative coalition. We're going to build on our own. And you see how much success we've had with that new policy since 1965. Since 1965, we've been continuously being slaughtered. Let's remember again who is president, the man that ended our only viable political way of surviving. All right, what do you do? I wrote a memo to the American Conservative Union Board in 1971, just those who think that I make these things up, I have it with me, in which I urged, this was before McGovern became the candidate, and it looked like Muskie would run a good race against Nixon. I suggested that the optimal conservative position for 1972, which was the title of this, the optimal conservative position would be for Nixon to lose the presidency in a close race so that we didn't get hurt too badly in kind. We can give up 10 or 15 seats. We still can slide through with the conservative coalition majority. Now, what does that do? When you lose a close presidential race, you don't get wiped out in the House. You have your rough basis for the conservative coalition, and what happens? The same Republicans who are backing liberal policies when the Republican is president, all of a sudden, because they're in the other party, are against it. They don't have to be great men of principle. By and large, of course, they're not. They're not bad either, by the way. They're just ordinary folk trying to do something. All of a sudden, they're against them. Southern Democrats don't like them either. They're becoming, and there's a couple of saints like Goodlow Byron from my state of the Democratic Party in the North who also comes and votes with us too. And there's how we win. But as long as there's a Republican president in there, they're going around kowtowing him. I think it was Howie said about that White House. You cannot understand, unless you're in Washington, how important it is to these people to get invited to a White House dinner. That can set their whole policy view for years. Get the Republicans out of the presidency. That's our only hope short term. Now, maybe we can build to electing a president sometime. But not now. I mean, the facts of life are Ford came out in the last issue of U.S. News saying he is going to run the next time, And believe me, you're going to lose if you challenge him in the primary, because no matter how liberal he is, the Congress is going to be more liberal, and all the conservative Republicans are going to rally to him, except, you know, those of us who know better. But the average guy out there is going to see Ford, the average Republican supporter, is going to see Ford defending against the Democratic mob. They're going to rally to him. I mean, that's a fact of life. And if you go third party, you're going to split the Republican vote, because some of the conservatives are going to go with Ford. Even if you have an ideal type ticket like Reagan and Wallace in terms of electoral appeal, I mean ideal, you're still going to lose. The only answer is the kind of thing that Howie's doing and the kind of thing Ed is doing, the kind of thing that the people who are trying to work through Congress, I think it's even more important to get out in the grassroots than in Washington. That's the only hope. It really is. And then what do? You elect a leadership who will play politics. That's what politicians are. They're supposed to play politics. Huh? There was nothing wrong about Halleck dealing, quote, in back rooms. That's the kind of thing the media wants you to feel bad about. That's what he's supposed to. That's what a legislature is. It's dealing. Let's get back and make some good deals, damn it.